and all this sort of thing. And it sets up an ideal. And young people, they listen to the songs. They think this is life. They get into relationships. It's not like that. They get angry and frustrated. Things break down because they're disillusioned, because something's been set, an ideal has been set before them. And life doesn't live up to the ideals. Let me tell you, life is better. Okay? But they don't live up to these prefabricated ideals that's set before people, and all sorts of problems come out as a result. And that's why there is such a debate at the moment about who the next Doctor Who's going to be and who the next James Bond's going to be. Are we going to have a black actor playing James Bond? Are we going to have a woman being the first female Doctor Who? The reason that question is a burning question in the world, because it actually doesn't matter. But the reason it does matter to so many people is because they know that whoever's set before, it shapes people's aspirations, it shapes them, what their expectations from life will be. So they're fighting to it for that position of influence. I'm saying all this because I don't want you to think that the idols are just statues made out of stone. I don't want you to think that, because that would be misleading. There are statues made out of stone that are referred to here in the passage we're going to look at in a moment. But if I could take you in my time machine, in my TARDIS, and we go back to the 4th century BC, to the building of the Parthenon, the great temple in Athens, on the top of the Acropolis, and we could see the Elgin marbles. Has anybody seen the Elgin marbles in the British Museum? The Greeks still fighting. They want them back, don't they? Right? These statues of horses and gods and stone. There's this great battle going on. They want them back. If you had been there when that frieze was intact on the front of that temple at the time, it was not just complete and brilliant artistry, lifelike representations, action, but all the statues were painted and in lifelike colors. I'm telling you, that was the IMAX cinema of the ancient world. It's like we all trot down to the cinema to go and watch this big frieze, and we're impressed. This big impression is made upon us, on our thinking, on our ideals, on our ideas. And people would have stood before the Parthenon frieze, and they would have stood there transfixed. They didn't know about movies and TV to see this. Sculpture was like, would blow their minds. It's an amazing thing to look at. And it would leave this deep impression on them that they would take away. Have you seen the Parthenon? Yes, I've seen the Parthenon. I've seen it twice. You'd have nerds who'd been to see it 15 times. Talking about idolatry, this passage here is about idolatry. John Piper said, "Idolatry can be active in my heart when I'm gathered with the people of God. I whenever I think that I can't meet with God unless X is present, if that X is not Jesus Christ and the God's Holy Spirit, idolatry is at work in my heart." So he's saying anything that gets between us and God. I can meet with God, but only in this circumstance, or in this place, or with that person, or with this music. If we get into that place, idolatry has started to develop in our hearts. And the truth is, all of us, to varying degrees, we are shaped by the world. Yes, if we're honest, we're shaped by the world. And we are shaped by the media, aren't we? In some measure or degree, all of us Christians, let me say, we have to learn not to watch TV, but to watch TV. Do you hear what I'm saying? We have to have our eyes open, our ears open, our hearts alert. We have to be seeing what impressions, what opinions, what views are being invested into us, because as God's people, what is to shape our lives? The world or the Word? Right? What is going to shape your opinions about the refugee crisis or terrorism or any other subject? What is shaping your views? Is it the world? Are you getting it from the world or are you getting it from the Word? We have to be thinking about these things. I'm going to read it to you, honestly. Do you know what? Which is really ironic. ISIS. They really hate idols, so they keep telling us. Actually, I've got it here. Keep telling us how much they hate idols, keep blowing up things, don't they, recently? But it seems that they would do anything to get themselves on TV, wouldn't they? They want to be the ones on the big screen that everybody's talking about, everybody's looking at, everybody's idolizing, the people who are shaping and making an impression on us all. They're as idolatrous, I tell you, as any statue. We've got to be so careful. We are in an image-obsessed society. Images, images, images. How do you see yourself? How do you see yourself? Your image, are you how image conscious are you? Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, you can look at yourself in so many different ways. Your image, your image, your image. And judge yourself according to your image and how that image fits alongside the idols. Or you can see yourself as God sees you. Or you can hear what the Lord would say to you through his word. And let that be you. And that be the you you live out of. Not what the world has to say. So we're going to be looking at the passage. It's in four sections. From verse 15 is the first section. I'm going to just explain it to you a little bit before we read it. Verses 15 through to 18 is the first section, and each of these sections contains a warning. A warning. The first one begins, verse 15. Watch yourselves very carefully. You see it there? That first section is a warning. Watch yourselves very carefully. This is a very subtle danger, and Moses is speaking to the subject. If you go down to verse 19, you'll see the second section begins there. Beware, beware. And then as you go down to verse 21, the third section that I've broken it up into, we notice Moses talking about how the Lord was very angry with me. He's saying, not only you got to be careful, you got to beware. Why? Because without meaning to, you could end up stirring up the Lord's anger in your life. That's what we've got to be careful of. Displeasing the Lord. And then verse 23, it says again, take care, take care. And if you drop down to verse 24, you'll see a picture of God as a consuming fire, a jealous God, a jealous God. Well, let's read it. I'm going to start from verse 15, first section. Therefore, watch yourselves very carefully. Since you saw no form on the day that the Lord spoke to you at Horeb out of the midst of the fire, beware lest you act corruptly by making a carved image for yourselves in the form of any figure, the likeness of male or female, the likeness of any animal that's on the earth, the likeness of any winged bird that flies in the air, the likeness of anything that creeps on the ground, the likeness of any fish that's in the water under the earth. And beware lest you raise your eyes to heaven. And when you see the sun and the moon and the stars, all the host of heavens, you be drawn away and bow down to them and serve them. Things that the Lord your God has allotted to all the peoples under the whole of heaven. But the Lord has taken you and brought you out of the iron furnace, out of Egypt, to be a people of his own inheritance, as you are this day. Furthermore, the Lord was angry with me because of you. And he swore that I should not cross the Jordan and that I should not enter the good land that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance. For I must die in this land. I must not go over the Jordan, but you shall go over and take possession of that good land. Take care, lest you forget the covenant of the Lord your God, which he made with you, and make a carved image, the form of anything that the Lord your God has forbidden you. For the Lord your God is a consuming fire, a jealous God. When you father children, and children's children and have grown old in the land, if you act corruptly by making a carved image in the form of anything and by doing what's evil in the sight of the Lord your God so as to provoke him to anger, I call heaven and earth to witness against you today that you will soon utterly perish from the land that you're going over to the Jordan to possess. You will not live long in it, but you will be utterly destroyed, and the Lord will scatter you amongst the people, and you will be left just a few in number among the nations where the Lord will drive you. And there you will serve gods of wood and stone, the work of human hands that neither see, nor hear, nor eat, nor smell. But from there you will seek the Lord your God, and you will find him. If you search after him with all your heart and with all your soul, when you are in tribulation and all these things have come upon you, in the latter days you will return to the Lord your God and obey his voice. For the Lord your God is a merciful God. He will not leave you or destroy you or forget the covenant with your fathers that he swore to them. So should we look through it together? First section, verse 15 through to 18. And my subheading for that section is word, not image. Word, not image. Word, not image. And the underlying principle and all of these things is set out in that opening verse. It's there. Therefore, watch yourself very carefully. Since you saw no form. You saw no form. Let's put this another way. Have you seen God? Have you seen God? Then how on earth are you going to describe him? How on earth are you going to draw a picture or make a sculpture? How on earth are you going to do that which you have not seen? You've got no experience of this whatsoever. How on earth are you going to go about it? Imagine for a moment there's a police lineup, following a theme from earlier. Police lineup, and you're called to witness because you have had a conversation over the phone with a perpetrator of a crime, and you've got a presentation of all these people in the line, and you're being asked to identify the person who you spoke to on the phone just by looking at them in the line. I mean, can you imagine the folly of sitting there thinking to yourself, well, that one looks like they've got the kind of voice that I heard. Nonsense, isn't it? And if you make that mistake, it could be very incriminating to somebody. You're entering evidence into a case that has bearing. Well, if we think it'd be folly to do something like that, how much more foolish it would be to try and trespass and venture out to say what you haven't seen, which you don't know, and to try and describe which you have no experience of whatsoever. It would be folly, wouldn't it? Utter folly. Those of you who know me know I am. I think imagination is a wonderful facility. It's a wonderful facility. But like every good gift that we're given by God, it has its place. It has its limitations. And it is a fool who uses the good in the cause of evil. You've got to be so, so careful, haven't you? Because, as we're told here, we're talking about God. We're talking about God here. This is something far more serious than a police lineup, serious as that is. And we've just read here, haven't we? There in verse 24, what is God like? He's a consuming fire and a jealous God. Does it sound like a good idea in those terms? To try and say what he has not told you to say, or show what he has not shown you with a God like that. He has the right, surely, to determine how he's worshipped, how he's represented. He is God. It's not up to us. It's not up to you. It's not up to me. It's up to him. Calvin. 5 points of Calvin. I wonder if anybody here could do 5 points of Calvin. The Diet of Dort. The Diet of Dort. Anybody know what the Diet of Dort is? see me afterwards. Okay, you're on. The 5 points of Calvin, but one of them was total depravity, total depravity. And what he meant by this, I'm giving a very basic view on it, is that human beings in our fallen state are in and of themselves incapable, firstly, of saving themselves. If you can save yourself, why would God need to send you a savior? It's pretty self-evident. We cannot, in and of ourselves, work out the mind of God. Can you look into the mind of God? Can you work out his thoughts? Can you anticipate his actions? But he can show you. He can tell you. He can reveal these things to you. And when it comes to worship, surely, isn't it down to God to determine what pleases him? Rather than for us to say, well, I'm going to do this for you, and you better like it. We're not able in and of ourselves to please God, to know God, or to save ourselves. Because in that sense, we are broken. We are broken. And we need the Holy Spirit. We need his help. We need to be helped to see and to worship him as we should. We need to be saved. And God is a gracious God. As we read at the end of the passage, he is a merciful God. And he does save people, doesn't he? He can rebuild us. So, looking at this passage, how does God choose to represent himself? Not by these carved images, very clearly. Verse 15, it says there, since you saw no form on that day, what did they experience? On the day the Lord spoke. He spoke. How has God chosen to represent himself? By his word. Yes? So that's really my first point. My first point. Word, not image. He's the God of the word, not God of images. He's not interested in image. He's interested in word. So that's the first point. God's word represents God. And that's why having a Bible is so precious, isn't it? We have his word. So let's move on then to verses 19 through to 20. The first point I said was word, not image. Now the second section is God, not nature. God, not nature. So most Christians, I trust, have not got a private shrine with a statue of God at home which you use for your personal devotions. Most Christians have got to the point where that kind of idolatry is not a feature of our worship. But what is indicated here in this passage, lest you raise your eyes to heaven and you see the sun and the moon, the stars, the host of heavens, and be drawn away and bowed down, shows us something about our very nature. That though we might have got past the kind of shallows, there is a capacity that each of us have to make an idol out of practically anything. You could end up using practically anything as a means by which you place between you and God, and you only come to God through this thing. For centuries, people worshipped the sun, didn't they? Worshipped the sun. And we scoff and we go, oh, they worship the sun. But think about it. Tell me, is the sun magnificent? Is it mysterious? Do our lives depend upon it? Is it reliable? All these things, does it do us good? When you think about it, you can see how a mind can start to say, in some way, I could see all those characteristics, all those features really are the characteristics of God, aren't they? So from now on, whenever we see the sun in the sky, it will make me think of God, and I will direct my worship to God through my love of this thing that God has made, the sun. And you become a sun worshiper. We can be a bit disdainful of it, but how many of us would agree that you experience something of the Creator in the creation? I'm not just talking about the pleasure of a nice walk or a fantastic view, but the sense of awe, of wonder, a creation. The black sky when there's not a cloud, there's a full moon, and every single star is out and all the streetlights are miles away. There's a sense of wonder and awe, isn't there? And you say, that's the place where I meet with God. That's the time, my time with God. That commune with nature is more than just commune with nature. That's where I'm having my spiritual experience in nature. Let me ask you something. Of all that has been made, all that is, what uniquely has been made by God to represent him? Human beings. Genesis. Yes? Male and female, he made them in his image. Not the sun, not the moon, not the stars. Us. Us. Now that's a remarkable thought, isn't it? That's a remarkable thought. Don't go worshipping all these things. Who is being made in his image? If there is an image of God in the world, it's us. That leaves me feeling ever so slightly queasy, if I can put it like that. Because I tell you what people do. They take that and then they end up worshipping people. The reason people are pop stars, there's a reason for that, aren't they? Why it's called teen idol or pop idol or American idol, because we set people up. We put them on their pedestal. We don't want to hear anything bad about them. We idolize people. And we experience God through their words and their actions and their appearance. Their appearance. And some people are fantastically good at keeping up appearances, aren't they? So they seem unblemished and manicured and impressive. The superheroes, the film stars, the pop singers, the actress. How different is she from the statue of Venus that might have stood in some temple hundreds of thousands of years ago? The perfect woman, the perfect man. And people worship them. They get their values, their ideals, their aspirations, their dreams are governed by idols. Idols. And they say, well, I didn't make them. God made them. But you only have to listen on X Factor. The conversation, I don't mean to be mean to anybody who's at X Factor. If they're listening to this, I apologize on the internet. I know we have a big following of contestants from X Factor on our website. But if they're listening here, sometimes you see them and they look all glammed up on the lights and the shine and the glitz and the glamour. And then you hear them in conversation. And you see they're just, they're just flesh and blood. We're all the same. We're all deeply flawed. Deeply flawed. Because the truth is, the whole of nature is fallen. Again, my TARDIS, if I could take you all in the TARDIS, I would love to, but I know there's an angel that will, with a flashing sword, that will prevent us, even the TARDIS, from passing through, back into the garden, back into Eden, to see the world as it was. Do you ever use your imagination to try and imagine the world as it was? I find that I meet that angel with a sword and says, I can't pass. I can't even imagine the glory of it, how it was before the fall, before all the suffering and the poverty and the afflictions and the disasters and everything else. And likewise, no eye has seen or ear heard or heart understood the good things that God has for those who love him. There's a time coming where the world, will there be a new heavens, there'll be a new earth. I can't get my head around it. But I'm told that we're going to see it. But right now, we're in a fallen, broken world. And everybody's fallen and broken. We're not worthy to represent him, are we, as of ourselves? We can't do it. We're broken. We're broken. But by his help and through his work in our lives, he does wonderful things with us. He gives us, uniquely amongst all the creatures, the capacity to hear him speaking. Hear his word, and not just to hear it, but to put our confidence and trust in what he's saying. And more than that, and I think this is incredible, to speak it. And that's an amazing thing, isn't it? He's given us his word. I don't know about you, but the pagans, they're obsessed with nature. They think counting God through this nature and the trees and the forests and the plants and all these sort of things. But all that's mirroring back to them is a broken mirror reflecting a fallen world. And so the consequence in their morals and their lives is as broken and fallen as the world which they observe. Because there's only one way to see God, and that's through his word. It's through his word. I love the hymn, "How Great Thou Art." How great thou art? How great thou art, even. I hear the brook. I feel the gentle breeze. And it's lovely, isn't it? When you sing that part, that verse, it's quite immediately straight. All that bluebell walk we went on, wasn't it lovely? But the real thunder of the verse, the real thunder of the hymn, doesn't leave us there. We're not supposed to just walk through the woods as Christians and commune with God in nature. We go on. And when I think of God, his son not sparing, but sent him to die, I scarce can take it in. No dandelion will preach Christ to you, Christ crucified. No great mountain, the Matterhorn, will not declare the gospel of Jesus Christ. It's you and me speaking his word. There is a general revelation, isn't there, in the world? A general grace, a common grace that's given to the world. There's so many good things in the world. And by them, you can tell there is a God. You can tell that he's good and provides. You can tell, looking through a glass darkly, you can tell many, many things. But to us, and that's, I think, the thunder of verse 20, at the end of that passage there, to us, he's brought us out of the idolatry and the iron furnace of Egypt and its idols and being influenced totally by the world. To us, he has saved us and made us his inheritance. We have a special revelation, special grace, saving grace through Jesus Christ, because we've heard the gospel and believed it and preach it to the glory of Jesus Christ. You need it. You need it because, you know, otherwise what you have, I have a communion with God when all is well and the sun is shining and the mountaintops are gleaming. But when the rain, which never happens in this country, drives and drives and drives, where is God? When I'm prosperous and wealthy and all things are good, my communion is full, my cup overflows. When you're bankrupt and people are throwing grenades into cafes, where is God? Where is God? But if you know him through his word, you know where God is. You have fellowship with God at all times, through sickness, in health, a constant communion, a constancy of God. And that the world doesn't have. That's what Romans chapter 1 is all about, isn't it? Romans chapter 1, all these people who've ended up giving up the worship of the Creator to end up worshiping the creation, they love the world. And everything in it, they're obsessed by it. But it's a fallen, broken world, and so consequently everything they do is fallen and broken as a result. That's what Genesis chapter 1 is about, at least in part. You know, they had come out of Egypt and the idolatry of Egypt. These people just loved the world and everything that was in it. And God brought them out, and he shows them day by day, these people that you've just been mastered by, they worship the very things, the sun, the moon, and the stars, that your God made. He's so much greater than all the gods of Egypt. They worship these things as if they're gods. They're not gods. Our God made all this. One question I probably ought to answer before I finish this point, and that's this. What can we make, now that we have a man, Jesus Christ, who has appeared and not just spoken, Can we make an image of him? Can we make a representation of Jesus and worship God through a picture or a statue or a film of Jesus or something like that? Let me just ask that question. Because the Muslims are very, very clear on this point. They say, absolutely not. They think it's completely blasphemous that we worship Jesus, you know. Because they say, how can you worship a man? He's just a creation. And we say, no, Jesus is God manifest in the flesh. We're not coming to God through a man. We are coming to God in Jesus Christ. No mediation. We come straight to God. And Jesus is God the Son manifest in the flesh. And beyond that, not only do they think we're idolatrous to be worshipping Jesus, the very idea of making an image of Jesus and worshipping at a statue, that for them is like putting a stick up their nose. Well, let's think about the question for a minute. Is it okay? Is it okay to make pictures of Jesus? Let's turn it around. So, what color eyes has he got? What's the cut of his hair? What does he wear? How tall was he? Color of his skin? Listen, there are people in this room. If we put our corporate knowledge and experience of the Bible together in this room and add it all up, the number of hours that this group of people have spent reading the Bible and added it all up, and all these people searching the Bible, and it seems there's not one of you that can tell me one thing about how he appears. Do you not think that this is on purpose? We don't know. He has shown us no form. No form. So then who on earth do we think we are to try and present it? Aren't we doing the same thing? At least we should be asking ourselves that question. Asking ourselves that question. How are we supposed to see God? Through his word. Through his word. So we are God's people, and we are to represent God through his word. Second point. The third point is brief. Verses 21 to 22. At this point, Moses interjects a bit of personal testimony. He's been talking about the dangers of idolatry, and then suddenly he's talking about his own personal testimony. Why did Moses lose out on the thing that meant the most to him in all the world? What meant the most to Moses in the world? To go into the land? I think there's something meant more to him than that even. God's pleasure. To please the Lord. And God was angry with him. He displeased the Lord. And I think by comparison, the loss of the land is nothing. Actually, in a way, by obeying the Lord and not going into the land, he regained the pleasure of God, though he lost the land. And he counted himself, I think, happy that he had his relationship with God. That's the main thing, isn't it? It's the main thing. But disobeying the Lord is painful and costly. Costly. That's clear from his testimony there in those verses. So clearly, he's telling us the importance of listening, hearing what we're talking about tonight, hearing the dangers of these things, being obedient to on this point, that the consequences of disobedience could be tragic. Careful. Careful. Beware. Anger. Jealousy. It's his prerogative, isn't it? It's his prerogative. And this is, I'm going to finish this third point. See, if we said last week that obedience is an unusual verb because it doesn't just describe one thing, like running or jumping, but it describes two things. To obey is to hear and to do. So, hear and do is different, isn't it? And he's talking about obedience in this passage. We have to do this. We have to do this. So my third point is that it's God's people who hear, not just hear, because there's lots of people who've got the Bible. There's lots of people who read the Bible. But God is looking for a people to represent him who don't just hear, but also do what he says. Heed the warnings and act on them. And they can represent God by speaking his word. Glances at the clock. Fourth and final point. Verses 23-31. So we've said, word, not image. God, not nature. Obedience, not disobedience. This is love, not law. Love, not law. Because you may know that we can get a hold of all of this. And we can go ahead and do all the right things, but be doing them for all the wrong reasons. It's possible, isn't it? And the wrong reason would be to do this without love. To obey out of duty because of the law, rather than out of love and trust and faith in God, who is our Father and cares for us. That's possible, isn't it? We can do it. We can become legalistic. And you can be absolutely scrupulous about images and pictures and get rid of the whole thing. But you haven't in your heart just got a love and a delight in God's word. Because that's surely what he wants, isn't it? To foster that loving relationship. It's not so much about what he gets rid of. It's about what fills your life. Your loving trust in God expressed through his word. That relationship. And in that last passage from verse 23 onwards, he describes this tragic descent of these people who have got everything. They've got wonderful lives, they've got land, they've got children, they've got prosperity, and then they gradually, their hearts begin to drift away from God. They get cold-hearted and forgetful, that their love for the word becomes dampened. And that direction leads them into all manner of problems, one following after the other, until they're experiencing loss and pain, and the people around them are totally materialistic, and in truth, they've become completely materialistic themselves. They're just interested in the world. They become worldly. Their love for God has waned. They've come to love the world, and they're hanging out with people who love the world too. And there in that place, his people, who are called to love him and to delight in his word, has turned their backs on him. But he's there, isn't he? This is him working out his purposes. Because God's people, he's put his spirit in. And something happens on the inside of us. We talked about this last week, didn't we? Where you spent a certain amount of time. And do you ever get hungry for the word? A thirst after righteousness. You get dry and miserable and sad. And suddenly you get to a point where there's only one thing. One thing I want. There's only one voice I want to hear. Only one word from one person that will refresh my soul. I must see God. I must know God. I must hear him again. I must turn and set my face and find him and not let him go till he's spoken to me and it's changed my heart. My life has turned around. Because all of this doesn't matter. It's all fading. It's all passing. But he endures forever. That place. And he describes this person drifting away, and there in the bottom and the pyre, in the mire of it all, in the mire of their sin, God meets them and shows himself to them once again through his word as faithful and merciful and merciful, mercy and love. What kind of Christians do we want to be? What kind of people do we want to be? Do we want a people who scrupulously deal with all the exterior business? But on the inside, we're cold, far from God. Wouldn't it be better, in one sense, to be a rather messy Christian? Gets messed up. How many times do we fall into idolatry? How many times do we put something between us and God? Our sin, our righteousness, you name it. We could put anything. We could put a dishwasher there. You name it. We can put something there. Isn't it better to admit it and be a broken believer who is finding real love and mercy through Jesus Christ in their day-to-day life and his faithfulness, and it's real? Because that's what God's looking for, a real, deep, loving relationship with us through his word, not duty faith. Because in one sense, it's an idol. It's just another idol. Here's the thing. you can know God. You don't have to imagine him. You don't have to dream it. You can know him. And I think, let me just say this as a riser on at the end of that. Right at the beginning of the passage, you saw no form. You saw no form. He is withholding things from us. There are things he's not telling you. There's things he's not showing you. There's things you will never understand. It's okay. It's okay. He's a good God. And you can trust him. You can trust him. There's a reason. There's a purpose. He's working it out. You can trust him. You see, God's people are the people who hear and do his word from their hearts. And they're the ones that he calls to represent him in the world. Conclusions. We are living in an image-saturated world. The hamburger on the photograph bears no resemblance to the one that you try to eat. The girl, it's Photoshop. It's Photoshop. People say a picture is worth a thousand words. What is the hurry? Why are we so shallow? What is the rush? We're being misled. We're being misled en masse in a vast way. But God is speaking still. Will we hear him? Will we hear him? Image, it's just surface and it's passing. The word, it abides forever. We mentioned ISIS. ISIS are on this iconoclastic rampage, aren't they? They're smashing up these buildings and blowing up temples and all the rest of it. And they say, we're following Muhammad's example because that's exactly what he did at the beginning of his life when he was jealous about the fact that the Kaaba stone was full of idols and wanted to recover it. And he brought his army and he recovered the Kaaba stone and took all the idols out and threw them all over the ground and made it a place where there was no idols. And he was opposed to idolatry. And you know what? He was living at a highly idolatrous time. If you went into a church in the time when Muhammad was born and you were seeking the Lord and you wanted to go to church and find out what the gospel was, the churches were full of statues and full of paintings and people kneeling down and kissing them and all the rest of it. You can get the idea why he might have come away saying idolatry has no representation for what I find my impression of what our God is all about. And it wasn't just Muslims who were angered by the idolatry of those times. There were riots in the streets in the 6th century. Christians who were outraged by the idolatry they found in the church, inverted commas. And I'd love to say that the church dealt with its problems and dealt with its issues. But you see in the Reformation 1,000 years later, Luther and Calvin, all the rest of it, it's exactly the same. Exactly the same. And there were riots and iconoclastic riots in those days too. And it's just like the days of Joshua when they had to cleanse the land, or the days of the kings when they had to keep. It's something in our hearts that just, it's like Calvin put it, the heart is a factory of idols. And we have to keep being careful and rooting them out and rooting them out. I'm not against art. Right? You go into the portions of scripture that describe the temple, or that describe the tabernacle, they were full of the most fantastic artistry. Beautiful artistry. But in its place, everything in its place and in its time, not standing between you and God. In one sense, however badly I preach or well I preach, it's the gospel that's the power of God to salvation, not my capacity to preach it well. Everything has its place. That's not to say one shouldn't try to do things well, right? But that's not what you worship. That's not where we meet with God. There isn't a call for us today to build temples. As Christians, we're not called to build temples. The Muslims will continue to build mosques, and they'll have their geometric designs in there because they say, look, we're not idolaters. And you go to the synagogue and there's an ark at the back and you open the door and inside there's a copy of the Bible. They say, look, we're not idolaters, we're people of the Word. If we were to open up the closet of our hearts, the Holy of Holies, the secret place, what do we find in there? Do we find Christ and Him crucified? Is that who we are? Because we are the temple of the living God, aren't we? The people of God. Is that what we find? What kind of people are we? Is the word from your heart, how you see yourself, how you see the world, how you see God? Or is it the world? The world. I know the Catholics and the Orthodox keep telling us that they don't worship idols, they venerate them. I am going to finish, I promise, right? They venerate these pictures rather than idolize them. But I just think it's a bit like semantics, isn't it? The language is too close. It's all too close to comfort. It's not careful. And I think there is a problem in those big denominations of where the word stands, whether the word is the most important thing, or whether the word is down here somewhere that the clergy and all the rest of it oversee and look after. There's an ambivalence about that. And I think it's manifest in the way worship appears. And it'd be good to clean house and get right. People in Korea, there's a Buddhist country with 25% of the population are evangelical Christians, and from time to time, somebody, a bit of a fundamentalist, goes out and attacks one of the local Buddhist shrines and cuts the head off one of the statues of Buddha. Am I saying that we Christians should go out on our iconoclastic campaign to bring down temples? No, 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 I'm not. I'm not saying that. I'm saying what's said at the end of 1 John. Keep yourselves from idols. We have enough work on our plate keeping our hearts pure and holy, and make sure there's nothing standing between us and a holy God. And Jesus' blood availing for us. It's enough. It's enough to occupy us. We're going to sing something to close. I hope that encouraged you just to remember the preciousness of the Bible, the preciousness of the Word, the preciousness of Christ, the preciousness of knowing Him, of being His people, of having His Word, of being His ambassadors. And keeping ourselves free from idols. Let nothing be an idol in your life. 494 is our closing hymn. 494.